You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend.
Welcome back, friends. Please make sure your pod seats and tray tables are in their upright and locked position. The airlock has been sealed and docking clamps have been released for an on-time departure to the Functional Nerdverse. Patrick, we'll be very fortunate if this plane doesn't come down straight out of the Functional Nerdverse with Hobbs, who could not possibly have crawled on me more in the middle of green room there.
Yep.
Are we good, sir? He unplugged my mic a minute.
I'm just like, oh, I didn't realize you're busy. I need some attention.
He's been over like off screen yonder for the first recording we did earlier today, and well before then as well. And now he's pouting. He's pouting because I shoved him off my lap. And So he's decided he's going to go there right within sight and kind of he's turned his back to me. Mm-hmm. He's going to give me one last wistful look over his shoulder. Yes.
Yes. And meanwhile, Ronan the dog came in with a chew and just did like a circle where he's just looking at me like, I have a chew. I have a chew. I have a chew. And then he walked back out of the room.
Just to show you.
Yeah. Yep. Just to make a point. Yep. You seem blissfully unassailed by beasts of various kinds, Daphne Fama. So good on you for that.
I trapped him actually for this. he is sad in a room somewhere. His name's Ash.
Oh, what manner of beast is Ash?
He is a white mutt. And that's all I got.
He has a boomstick.
Yeah.
A what?
A boomstick.
Oh, well, no. He does have pretty much, I don't know. I wanted to rip off that, but I couldn't, unfortunately.
It's fine. This is all the requisite number of limbs, and none of them are a chainsaw. So that's
yes.
Good. Yeah. Oh my God, chainsaw dog. Although that actually is a thing, I guess. Like there's an anime Chainsaw Man.
Yes.
Weird demon dog with a chainsaw face. I only know about this because of my son. But that's what teenage sons are for. They're telling you about chainsaw dogs.
There's some real questionable material in that.
Yeah, I mean, we've never been the sort of household to like closely police our kids' media. And, you know, Patrick, having met the Townsend children before, can tell you exactly how feral that turns them. So I don't know.
Well, yeah. As we're recording this, Tracy told me earlier that there's a birthday party for a 14-year-old happening today at her house. And I'm like, bless your heart.
Yeah.
Bless your heart.
I mean, it is Deirdre's 14th birthday party. She actually turned 14 a couple weeks ago, but actually, not
I remember the earthquake.
Yeah, right. But she, given that it is her friend's, and given what we know of her to be true, I'm thinking any amount of chaos will be chaos that she is responsible for and not her friends, because she has foot soldiers, really.
Oh.
She's the queen of any room that she walks into. She'll be the one in control.
Did she inherit that from
how's
you?
How's this for? Oh no, not really. how's this for a segue? You might even say that she's a monstrous woman.
Whoa!
That was kind of low hanging fruit there. So on that subject, though, Daphne Fama, it's awesome to have you on because we have a Filipino setting. A Philippine setting, I should say, Filipina composed horror novel coming from you, which it's just deeply fascinating to me, the whole kind of setup of it. So, all right, can you brief our readers, our listeners, our audience?
Yes. Okay, absolutely. House of Monstrous Women is essentially a novel set in 1986 in the Philippines during the People Power Revolution, and it features a house full of monstrous women. And the protagonist goes into said house to play a very deadly game in order to grab the future she wants. And things don't go perfectly to plan.
It would be a disappointing house of monstrous women if they did.
Yeah, 100%.
All right. So as someone who knows absolutely literally nothing about the history of the Philippines in this period, or to be completely candid, almost any other period, I am really interested in the choice to make this essentially a kind of like late contemporary historical approach. Like, what about the setting of the Philippines is so crucial to what you want to do with this story?
100%. So, I mean, I don't know if y'all could catch based on my last name, Fama. I'm half Filipino. My mother actually lived through the People Power Revolution, but specifically this period, I wrote it because I was real angry at the political situation in the Philippines. I went to law school. I was doing an internship at the Security Exchange Commission in Manila, and this politician named Duterte was like sweeping in. Everyone loved him. He was definitely pro killing drug addicts, which I was not a fan of. And I was flabbergasted that anyone could be a fan of. And with him, he pulls the son of a dictator, the dictator that's ousted during the People Power Revolution, as like one of his buddies. And now that buddy is the president of the Philippines. And I was like, how is this happening? How could we do this? Like, not that long after it, we push these people out. And so that's where it came from.
I can tell you, have you ever watched the show Community?
I have. Yes.
We're in the darkest earth.
We are. The
darkest reality.
Oh, don't say that, because I know it's true.
You know what? In high school and for several years beyond, one of my best friends in the world was half Filipino. I just remember, like, so I'm like adjacent. Like, I know, like, he would talk about stuff, but and then it's kind of funny. He went into the army.
Oh,
and, like, he became army dude. And because he loved G.I. Joe, which is kind of
fair.
He always thought G.I. Joe was like the best thing. And he loved anything Asian, like comic books, manga,
just
anything like he could get his hands on there. And because of the, like, for whatever reason, he just loved the military and army. And he actually went into the army. And now he's out and he lives not far from here. He's got a family, and we never see each other. It's hilarious. We only communicate via Facebook.
No,
but it's just hilarious to me. Yeah.
I mean, you should, if you do see him again, ask him how his attempt to, like, live Evangelion went. I'm sure he's just full of depression and regret.
Yeah. Oh, God. Probably, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I had never thought of it in those terms. But, yeah, that's kind of what it is.
It is. Just like, yeah, why don't we indoctrinate you, put you in the worst possible situation, and then hope you turn out okay.
Yeah, I'm
thinking about the darkest timeline sort of thing, and connecting it back to like the book and its storytelling space and its world and everything. It's interesting to me that both here and now in like the United States and in the Philippines of 1986, that we have this sense of like we are rewinding back to something that we had before, what is a revolution but kind of an exorcism of sorts? Mm-hmm. It's an effort to like take something and remove it from a space because we believe it's harmful, we believe it's wrong, we're going to cast it out. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that the response to like this exorcism of sorts having kind of failed and being now you're haunted again by these sorts of like political specters of 1986, it seems like it's a really good fit for the idea of I will enter this haunted space. I want to kind of sit in that idea too of like how the Philippines and its particular mythologies line up in a way that's really conducive to this story.
Mm. No, I first want to compliment you on so many beautiful words, just said one after the other. That was just a great way to put it. But the monster that kind of features heavily in House of Monstrous Women is the Aswang. And like the Aswang is like the most popular monster in the Philippines. If you ask any Filipino or anyone who's ever been to the Philippines, like what's the scariest creature? They're going to be like the Aswang. And it's essentially this vampiric baby eating or dead eating creature. And it totally varies based on your region. And because I'm writing this from the setting of like the Visayas and Carigara, the Aswangs are essentially like this kind of generational curse. It's like this stone that you pass on usually from like mother to daughter. And it can only happen because a mother chooses to curse her daughter and the daughter chooses to accept it and they keep it moving forward. And even if you attempt to like live within the bounds of being good or trying to like live a normal life, no matter what, you are pushing that forward. There is no true exorcism even if you're the one giving it to the next generation, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So that idea of like this kind of the generational curse, again, like the political landscape sort of dovetails with that in its own particular kind of way. So I think that the angle of it being mother to daughter, and like the idea of a house of monstrous women, why is it, do you suppose, that so many mythologies, not just Filipino mythologies, but around the world, dwell on the idea of there being female monsters?
Yeah.
So
now,
many of them are embodied female.
This is not...
Because of Catholicism.
That's so fair. It's like, oh, we got the Virgin Mary, but every other woman?
Yeah.
Damn her.
Trash fire.
Trash fire. A Jezebel.
Have you ever watch Taylor Tomlinson, any of her comedy?
I don't know. I'm so bad with names.
So she grew up in a very Christian household, and was just living in that for a very, very long time. And so when she was a teenager, she actually signed like the purity pledge with her parents that she was going to stay a virgin and stuff. And she says, "Do you have any idea how difficult it is to just not only be, you know, very, very Christian and very, very into this whole thing and, you know, signing this pledge, and your friends are saying to you, I missed my period. Oh my God, I think I'm pregnant." And then she says, "I miss my period. And I think, oh my God, I am pregnant with the Messiah. I haven't done anything.
I didn't want this."
It's like, damn.
But my point to come back is that like there, I feel like there was a lot of, and I know that you were going to answer this question, but I have to interject. Pre Christianity, there was lots of empowerment tales. Post Christianity, those were dangerous and had to be eliminated. But that's my opinion. Anyway, sorry, Dad.
No, you were so right, Patrick. Like, you're actually insanely right for someone who I don't think has researched this topic.
I have not.
Awesome. Okay. So yeah, before the Spanish rolled into the Philippines, it was an animism-based religion. And women were essentially like an extremely powerful role. They would be like babayans, which is like female shamans who can communicate with the dead. They could heal. And they were essentially like equal with the datu or the chiefs, right? But then obviously these fucking dudes, these friars show up and like we killed a few of them, but they got in anyway. And so they started imposing their weird Catholicism, and all these babayan then became like witches, and they became aswang, and they're like evil. They truly were demonized beneath Catholicism because you're right, it's dangerous. And so honestly, that's exactly what happened. And of course we see it across in other places in the world. And I do think it's just like, we live in a patriarchal society. People don't really love it when women get high and mighty with these ideas and try to live outside of societal norms. But it, in the Philippines, it's definitely what you're describing, like historically.
And it was there. I mean, that's, if you look at it, that's kind of what the King Arthur myth is all about as well. And legends there, because there was nature, right? So it was about nature and the cycles of everything, and women were just as equal as the men in the cycles and everything happening. And then you kind of get this ideal of Christianity and Catholicism kind of coming into England, and that starts changing everything.
Mm-hmm. Damn, we lost so much cool stuff because of that.
Party foul.
I will throw it out that, like, yeah. that is a theme throughout The Wheel of Time by Robert Jordan. Because the women have magic and the men's magic is tainted, right, by the Dark One. And so but none, like, men do not trust the Aes Sedai because they're women with magic and they don't trust that. And like, it's this whole thing that kind of goes through the whole thing. And that's why, you know, they don't trust the White Tower. They think there's the White Cloaks who think women are all witches, and that the only magic, since the men's magic is tainted, all magic must be tainted, and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Damn. Oh, what's our PG-13 rating? Can I say, like,
we ask people to watch their motherfucking god.
Okay. Oh. Okay, awesome. Because I don't, like, this is not seem like the type of conversation sometimes where I'm like, shoot, that really sucks. Like,
yeah, dang. Fuck,
dang.
No, for sure. It's, I don't know, I think about, I find myself thinking a lot about the different ways that, you know, when we tell stories about monsters, because monsters are just intrinsically fascinating, we kind of link them up to human behavior. And we always kind of try to define monstrosity as, we kind of try to define monstrosity as opposite to humanity in some way. Mm. They're human beings, and then to be inhumane, to be not that, is to be a monster. But some of the most interesting monstrous things that are out there are deeply human in their nature. And I think that's where we get to your story in the case of Haraya, the main character's childhood friend, who invites her to the home, like, come play these games. And so I'm wondering if we can kind of pull a little bit at the idea of Haraya's family being monstrous. In
yes. No, I 100% agree with you. I do think that monstrosity is essentially defined by whoever is observing the monster. Personally, I don't think there's a single monstrous woman inside the house. I think every single woman is there because life has essentially pigeonholed her into a very hard, difficult place. And now she's attempting to survive or create a future for herself in whatever way she can. And in doing so, either pushes what's societally okay or ends up harming those around her, similar to how Haraya does. Even if I genuinely believe Haraya is a good person who doesn't want to hurt anyone else, she does. And she has to live with that guilt and she has to try to make it better.
And the context of it being like a game is interesting too, because I think that there's like layers to unpack there. Mm. Like, we're talking about life and death situations as a game, or like, this is how the game is played. I've been reading a lot of the Expanse books by James S.A. Corey, the creative team that is James S.A. Corey. And I'm actually reading right now one of the novellas that's sort of a supplemental and in between the various books, The Churn, the one that focuses on.
Oh, animals. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Is it?
And the... The
Amos.
Language of this is how the game is played comes up with some frequency there. And I think that the idea of a game as being the plot of a book where the game is life or death in its fundamental nature, and also is taking place in the context of an actual political revolution, is really interesting to me, because I think that that's part of how we excuse ourselves for unacceptable things going down around us, is that we say, like, well, this is just how it's done. This is just how it is. This is just sort of like the rules of the game. Like, calling something a game or calling something the way it's always been is just really like a permissibility structure that we're giving to something that we know we shouldn't do, but we also don't know how to disengage from.
No, 100%.
This is yeah. That's less a question and more of an observation thing.
I think that's a so like very cool and very like valid observation, because like you're right. If like honestly, what Marcus was probably thinking when he was sitting in his like white mansion full of stolen goods, he was like, "Y'all can't force me out. I won this election, even if I bought it, you know." And then to see every single person roll out, right, like their moms, the nuns, the priests, and being like, please fucking leave. He was like, you're not playing by the rules. But then he had to leave because the U.S. was like, nah, they're right. You got to go. And then they took him by helicopter and took him to Hawaii, which is like, good. You lost. You finally lost the game. Not on your terms, not with your rules, but with our rules. Right. And the only way we can win is essentially being like, no, we're going to redefine what the game is.
Yeah. And I think redefining the game is also just, it's something that we're struggling with, at least here in the United States, like nationally on the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are, I think we're coming to understand better than ever that some of the things that we thought of that were sort of coded into how democracy works and how, you know, fair practice works and how justice works were not actually coded into law. They were just kind of like the gentleman's agreements of how things ought to be done, which means that suddenly house rules can
yes
become
and.
A thing.
Yes, and. But yeah. It's like, yes, and some of them are coded, some of them are laws, but if you just ignore them and pretend they don't exist and everybody else kind of goes along with you who's in power and you just pretend they don't exist, then oh well.
Yeah.
The what only thing going against you is South Park.
Oh, fuck, dude.
Bring you guys, bring me home.
Yeah, that's I vividly remember I was in college when South Park was like first becoming a thing. And it was the thing, like if you were one of the cool kids, you were watching South Park, right? And I remember getting really disillusioned with it as a program. By the time I was like done with college and I was in grad school and like doing the sort of like demi-adulthood thing, I came to realize that South Park didn't have an ideology, or at least that South Park of like 20 odd years ago didn't have an ideology. It just was two guys who sort of looked at the world and said, all deeply felt convictions are intrinsically stupid. Whether you are Al Gore, who believes that we need to protect ourselves from environmental collapse, and we're going to call it man, bear, pig. Or you are someone who, you know, believes in this political spectrum or that political spectrum, all deeply felt beliefs are fundamentally stupid, and you're stupid for having convictions. And it seemed to me as time went on, like so deeply cynical, where it was just sort of like, lol, it's we should just kind of like go through life and it's whatever. That was sort of like masking itself as some sort of libertarian move, that finally I was like, I'm not watching this anymore. And now the things that are happening with South Park are happening, and I'm sort of like, what's going on with you guys right now?
Yeah,
suddenly cool again.
I show up at my Pathfinder table, and one of the players is like, "What service has South Park?" And I'm like, "Paramount Plus." I'm like, oh, okay. I don't think there's anything else I want to watch on Paramount Plus but South Park.
Right? Okay. Am I crazy for wanting them to consolidate 10,000 services just back into TV?
That is something Patrick has talked about quite a lot.
Oh, really? Nice.
Yeah, it sucks. You know, there's something called Philo as an example. And basically that's cable for streaming. But it's expensive, in my opinion. It's like it you're paying for cable again, right? But then you can kind of sort of drop your streamers but now you're back to cable. Mm-hmm. So you're gonna get Comedy Central, which then you could watch South Park as it airs. You're also gonna get like your other channels that are on basic cable kind of thing. But it's like 60, 70 bucks a month.
Oh my fucking God.
Okay. And but you're back to cable, right? Mm-hmm. It's fun. I do believe that Netflix won the streaming wars. And the reason I say that is because if you open up Netflix today, in America at least, you have shows from CBS and Paramount. You have shows from NBC. They just dropped the new Quantum Leap on there. You have a ton of stuff from AMC. You have a ton of stuff now from Stars. You have stuff from HBO. You have Comedy Central stuff. All these things are going to Netflix now because all these other streamers are like, we need to make money. Let's license our stuff to Netflix. And then it goes on Netflix and it becomes a hit again, right? Suits. They put Suits on Netflix after 15 years off the air or whatever it was. And it becomes a huge hit on Netflix. So much so that they're like, we're going to do a new show. We're going to do Suits LA. I watched that. That was the stupidest. And it's like, oh my God, this is so terrible. Why are you doing? Why? And it was because Suits was so popular on Netflix. They're like, well, we should try this again. Let's try another show. But yeah,
I'm so tired of that. But yeah, no, that's so fair. There's milking everything until it's dead.
I have a HD antenna for over the air. So I can actually watch sports because I do like sports ball occasionally. Yeah. But you can't watch that streaming without paying an arm and a leg. So I have an antenna that runs a wire to my TV so that I can watch live TV when I want to watch sports ball.
I haven't seen an antenna since I was a child. Like,
you can
get
them now that sticks on your window.
Oh my God. The future?
And then it runs a little cable to your TV and it gets the signal, because in America, at least, all the local stations are required to still broadcast a signal. And so they all broadcast in HD now.
Nice. I'm learning so much, honestly, about TV.
Yeah. Don't get me started. Here.
But I mean, to that idea of like, is this the future? Like, we've got vinyl coming back. Like, people are
I have a ton of vinyl again. Sitting people right here.
And DVDs.
It is cyclical. This is our generation. Just cycling back.
I bought a really nice turntable. And it's Bluetooth, and so it goes to a receiver that's over on the other side of me, and then I've got two speakers in front of me, and I can put vinyl on there. I've been buying vinyl, and then my aunt and uncle, they're like, we're downsizing. We have all these albums. Would you like them? And I'm like, I'll come check them out. And so I go, and they gave me like two boxes of albums that I now have. Nice. You know? So, yeah, vinyl.
Yeah.
Well, I think a big part of it is to the point of like, this is my generation that is doing this. Like, your generation is smart enough to have looked at what's happening and it'd be like, wait a minute. Like, yeah, streaming's great and I can kind of get what I want when I want close to instantaneously. But if somebody just decides that they're not licensing to that streaming service anymore, it's just gone.
Yeah.
It's not even there anymore.
There's nothing physical.
Yeah. My son just moved into college last week and he didn't bring a TV. What he brought was a cheap Blu-ray player with an HDMI hookup and his Blu-ray collection, which is not huge. He's got like maybe 6 or 8 of them. He's a sort of little baby Blu-rayer working on building up. Yeah. But his idea was like, look, they're going to have televisions around campuses and different lounges and whatnot, and they'll all have HDMI ports. And he says, if I want to watch a movie, I just want to be able to like jack this thing in and go ahead and do it because I don't want to run the risk that when I want to see this thing, it's behind a paywall just for that specific thing, like on Amazon, or that it's no longer on fill in the blank here. And it just sort of, and they can disappear stuff. Like what happened with Westworld?
Yeah.
It's as if it never happened.
He's thinking ahead. That's honestly brilliant.
So yeah, he's a generally acquisitive person. So the idea of like, what if I bought something is not alien to him.
Here's the thing that now scares the hell out of me about physical media. And we've gone far afield. But I have a ton of DVDs and I have a ton of Blu-rays because when I first moved to Colorado, I didn't have any friends really. And I was just kind of working. And so what I would do is I'd get paid and I would go to Best Buy. Mm-hmm. On the weekend. And I would buy like an entire season of Buffy, or I would buy an entire season of Angel. And then I started branching out into other things and buying, you know, like I would buy entire seasons of things. And so I would have lots to watch. And I have all those things. And I was 2 months ago years old when I found out those things rot.
What?
Yeah.
DVDs and Blu-rays rot over time, and they have a shelf life. I did not know that. And what's worse is if it's Warner Brothers, which a lot of my stuff is, because I got like Batman the animated series, Superman the animated series, the Justice League stuff. Apparently Warner Brothers used like the cheapest kinds of DVD media that they could. Those rot faster.
So how fast is the rot ones, though? Like when we're talking about rot,
yeah.
I believe it was 15 to 20 years.
Does it like collapse like a
no, organic? They just become unplayable.
Oh, I see.
It's not a like, rot, like it's not like fading away, but the media itself rots inside and no longer playable. And so now we have a patron, Stace. And Stace talks about how he has digitized all his media and he has it on a server. Like, I'm looking at that. Like, do I get an external DVD player, Blu-ray player, hook it up to a computer and just start like digitizing all of that stuff before it rots?
Yeah, before it's lost media, for sure.
It's kind of in the opposite direction of that. I, you know, in my day job, I'm an English teacher, and one of my colleagues in the department for a while, in like the late 2010s the whole 2010s, like as a decade, he got really into different types of ebook formats. You know, he got into ebooks, and he was like, this is great, I can have a bunch of different books that are on this device right here. And then he kind of just overnight, after a couple of years of that, I saw him actually like bringing in hard covers of things that were new releases. And I was like, did you get that from the library? He's like, no, I bought it. I'm like, what happened to your whole, I'm gonna declutter. And he said it was almost charming. And it really was charming, I guess. He said, like, I missed the feeling of when I finish a book, being able to close it and put it on my shelf. And it sits there almost like a trophy. Like, it's a reminder that the book existed. And he says, and I look at the cover art and I look at the person's name. And he says, I just feel differently connected to it. And he's like, I mean, I still have my e-reader and I'll use it for some things. He says, but I don't want that to be my primary mode of reading anymore.
Yeah. That's so human, honestly. Yeah,
and see, I thought you were going to go in a completely different direction with that.
Oh no.
Because at SF Signal, when I used to do SF Signal, one of our contributors was Fred, Fred Kish. And Fred was a very early adopter of ebooks.
Okay.
And I forget which device he used. But he used a device and he started buying up ebooks because they were relatively inexpensive at the time, right? And he loved it. He could have his entire book collection on this device. I think it was a Borders device. It may have been
like
Borders.
Like Kobo or whatever it was.
Yeah. And so he had all these books on there, and then literally overnight, they're like, we're no longer doing this. We're no longer supporting this. And all his books went away.
I would kill someone.
And so then he switched to a different device. I want to say he switched to like a Zune or something, like some, there was like a Microsoft one or something else.
That one's nasty either.
And he started rebuilding all his ebooks, and then that one went away as well. And all the licensing went away. And so all of his books went away. Yeah. Yeah, that's where I thought you were going to go with this.
No, was that, like, no. That
yours is way cuter than this. Yours is depressing.
Well, and, I mean, I'm thinking about this in part because I'm actually looking at, because there's two different House of Monstrous Women covers, and I'm looking at them right now, and they are both very striking, haunting
images. Which is your favorite? No, I won't tell my various people.
I think so. So this is obviously great for like audio podcasting. Sorry, sorry, listeners here. But there's one that has like sort of the shadowy purple trees that are kind of coming in from the side, and the just gigantic text of the title with sort of like veins coming down within it, and then presumably the main character kind of striding forward in the foreground. And then we have the other one, which has like an orange backdrop and the house in the distance, and there's kind of a filigree of flowers surrounding it, and then a hand with long nails that's dripping blood. I really like that second one.
Yeah, that's fair.
I like the second one because I feel as if the house as the space that you have to travel to is so important, and that the other cover doesn't give me the opportunity to process that in the same way.
That's so fair.
Yeah.
Patrick, you now must choose. You can just say purple or orange if you don't know.
I like the purple one.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Though I actually totally agree. They're so different. I feel like the purple one is more claustrophobic, and it's actually
for sure.
Yeah. And like they're Bellotti trees on either side of her, which are like really symbolic, both in the book and just for what they are, which is like gateways to the spirit world. But then the orange one, I agree, like that negative space, I also feel like it makes it much more ominous. And the corpse hand kind of like, I almost never, like when I look at it, my eye is on the house and then it goes to the hand. So it's almost like this terrifying thing in the foundation that you aren't aware of until it's a little too late. So both are good.
And I think, and again, covers, going back to the idea of like physical media, and it kind of works. It's not just like that we own it or that we physically possess it. It just like works on our brain a little differently too. I think they also send really different messages. Like the one that's mostly purple and claustrophobic, it looks to me like I'm thinking gory, and I'm thinking like classic horror genre page turner kind of thing. And the other one has a little bit more of like horror, but do it lit fic style kind of vibe to it, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, I agree. You can definitely, I mean, like I'm a debut author. I don't do anything except say yes.
You're like, I have a book.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just excited to be here. So when they show me pictures, I'm like, yes, this is genius. But they show me two totally different pictures. So it's cool to see how like different countries, different teams took the idea and ran.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of times there's marketing behind that, and there's psychology behind that, because what works in one country doesn't necessarily work in another.
Yeah, you worked in marketing, right?
I was a digital marketer for a very, very long time. I gave it up for Lent.
Okay. Do you feel like they did a good job?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm here, so they must have.
Yeah. No, and I mean, you can look at covers from different countries, and you can see why they did the things that they did, why they made the choices that they made, based on the culture.
Yeah.
Of where that book cover is happening, and what's going to pick, you know, what's going to make someone pick that book up.
Yeah. They're covers that feel very real. And when I say that, I'm saying that as someone who my books recently had a audio release. They had North American audio rights for a long time, but then they just sold the UK audio rights. And so they just had audio release in the relatively recent past out in the UK, which is cool, but they wanted to have their own covers for them. Mm. And so they flew the covers past me, and one of them, I mean, they're both, I'm on a level with you here. I didn't have a choice on either of these covers. And I love me and I love my books. But they are both AI covers.
Oh no.
100% generated by AI. One of them is fine.
Okay.
It looks okay-ish. I think it gives slightly the wrong message about the book. The second one for the sequel was a non-starter. I sent it back to them and I was like, this cannot be, because it looked like they had taken not actual clip art. I don't mean that, but that they had taken disparate elements from like a bank of images and just sort of like smashed them, like this one thing here and this one thing there. And like, we're going to kind of like put it over a landscape and make blurry edges. And then like, behold, and I'm like, no, this is not true. And I ended up putting them in touch with the original cover artist for the book releases in the United States. And they ended up licensing the covers from him.
Wonderful. Thank God.
So ultimately, my understanding is what's going to go over to the UK is going to have the same covers as had in, or very similar covers as existed in the US. But wow, man, I felt like I dodged a bullet there. And that's like,
yeah. I mean, talking about scary things coming from the future, like that's terrifying. We can't even get like an artist, but we're next. You know that, right? They're going to find a way to replace us.
No, they've already been feeding our stuff into Anthropic and whatnot. So we need to do something better for ourselves, which tells me it's time for Picks of the Week.
Oh, perfect.
We'll get to Picks of the Week in just a second. I wanted to take a moment to say it's been 3 years. 3 years since anyone has given us a star or a review on Apple Podcasts. And that's just insane. So, if you like what we do, please take a couple of minutes, go over to Apple Podcasts and give us a star and maybe some kind of kind words, like a review. And if you don't use Apple Podcasts, no worries. Take those same couple of minutes to give us a star and some kind words on your favorite podcast catcher or platform, whatever that may be. It really does help. Now, back to what you really wanted to hear, Picks of the Week.
All right. Patrick, can you give us a pick?
I can.
All right.
So my pick this week is Wednesday on Netflix.
Season 2, yes.
Yep. There's 4 episodes as of this recording available. I've only seen 3. But MB was telling me, another one of our patrons, that it's just an amazing show and I need to keep watching. And I'm like, I'm going to, my God, give me a minute. But I do enjoy that show quite a bit. And I love what they're doing with the second season, because there's more of the family involved. It's not just like Wednesday and Thing and occasionally Uncle Fester. Morticia's there. Gomez is there. Lurch is there.
Yeah.
And Pugsley is there as well.
Okay.
Pugsley now goes to Nevermore in this season. And I just love the show. I love the way they do the colors and the way they do the aesthetics and all the stuff. And they've got lots of people coming in and out as part of the cast this year. And it's just a fun show. It just really is. And I think the second half of it is going to drop in September, I believe, or September or October.
Okay. That seems on theme.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's just a lot of fun. I like it. It's good. Good stuff.
Fantastic. How about you, Daphne?
Okay. Well, so the thing that brought me joy this week is I went into like this weird quirky bookshop and I found this door knocker that's really like the size of my palm. Mm-hmm. And it's a giant bee gilded in gold. And if you read House of Monsters Swimming, there's bugs in it. Like, spoilers, so many bugs. But you like pick up the bee by like, it's thoracic. It's probably giant. Like, yeah. The big round butt, and it's so heavy when you use it, and I love it so much. I don't have a house, but one day I will, and I'm going to put that sucker on there.
My favorite part about this quick is that you bought a door knocker and you don't have the house to put it on yet.
I am aspirational.
I love that energy, though.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You're going to find the house. You're going to go to a realtor and be like, find me the house that fits this knocker.
That is the type of princess I'm looking for.
That'd be amazing. Oh my gosh. So this is kind of, I guess, a continuation, my pick from the idea of physical media as a theme, because I love the people in Shea Townsend. I'm a big fan. I created two of them, my very own self with help, and everything. So, I mean, they're good peoples. But man, they have a weird relationship to turning on the goddamn lights. I'll come into the living room and folks are like, one person's over here, like drawing or something, and another one's over there, like just sitting noodling around on the phone. And I go to turn on the light, and it's, you would think,
yeah,
and like they cannot deal.
That
right?
would be my reaction.
Right? Yeah. Right. And they're like, lights for plants. Ah. So, and I'm like, okay. And this can especially be a problem if they're already engaged in something where like, yeah, okay, they were here first, like they're watching a TV show or something and I don't get to like reset the terms. And I guess a solve could be that I would just go into a different room to read my book or whatever and turn on the light there. But then I don't know, I just want to be where the people are. So I was like, you know what, this is stupid. I feel stupid for doing this. And I bought this thing. And now that I have it, I regret nothing. So I bought the Glocusent Book Light, which I happened to buy off of Amazon, thus feeding the monster that is the Bezosaurus. If you don't wish to do that, I imagine that this or something very like it can be purchased elsewhere. But it's basically like a collar that you wear around your neck. It's got two little LED lights that are kind of on like adjustable arms. And when you make that adjustment, you can point them up at different angles. You can pinch them to different, you know, directions. It charges using a USB-C. And the charge lasts for 80 hours.
Wow.
It is a ridiculously long-lasting charge. You can light up one of the two arms that's pointing down off of your neck. You can light up both. You can do them in different like hues of light. If you want a bluer light, a whiter light, a yellower light, whatever, different intensities. It's very customizable. And to be honest with you, I found it useful not just for like, I want to be in the same room as you sitting on this couch with you, but you've decided to be a fucking vampire. And I guess I have to just like wear this weird yoke around my neck in order to see my book. It's useful for that, sure. But it's also been useful for like, we had to do a bunch of different like repair jobs and weird things when we were moving my son into his college dorm room. And so like I had this light around my neck so that my hands were free to do other stuff. And it's been handy. So if you're the sort of person who wants to be able to read in spaces where maybe you don't have total control of the lighting, you want to be able to do your honey-do list with your hands free, you're camping, you're taking a walk someplace in the dark. I don't know. It's got lots of uses. I've been really happy with the Glocusent book light. It only costs about $20.
So yes. I'm curious why you went with that instead of the thing that like the miners use. It's like a headband.
Oh yeah.
And it's got a little, it's got like, a, no, it's just a headband and it's got a little tray and then a mirror. And you put phosphorus up there and it kind of burns and smoke and it casts a light and you just have to be careful not to get it in your eyes. But other than that, like it's perfect. Why
would I think
you...
it was probably the cancer.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. I get second thoughts about those sorts of things.
Gotcha. Weird like gotcha. That. Gotcha. Okay.
Well, Daphne, it has been a ball talking to you. Thank you for squirreling with us.
It was so fun. I really enjoyed it.
people want to find the House of Monstrous Women, hopefully not in real life because that could be a problem, but at least in like a bookstore or other sorts of fun places, where can they find you and the cool things that you make?
You know, my website is literally my name, daphnefama.com. And then if you just like search my Instagram, it's Daphne Fama. And then Blue Sky, it's Daphne Fama. So just, you know, type my name into whatever search bar that you want. And then maybe something will appear, hopefully. And my book is in almost every normal bookstore, I think.
Fantastic. Nice. Well, it's been awesome having you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. All right. Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of The Functional Nerds. We really appreciate it. If you liked this episode, or really any of our episodes, please consider backing us over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can get access to some cool stuff and help us to keep the lights on. You can also show your support by mentioning us and sharing any of our episodes on your own social channels to help boost the signal. Trust me, that can be huge.
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, "Hey, I really love what you do," I'm like, "I'm sorry. Do you know who I like? I think you have me confused with someone else."
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.